You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, today, we're talking plant-based. As sales records for plant-based foods continue to be smashed, the media is packed with ethical consumer advice, and lots of it is aimed at motivating us to take the vegan leap. There's no doubting that this stuff is mainstream thinking now. But it's easy to forget that vegans have been saying for years and years that eating plant-based is more ethical and healthy and environmentally friendly. In the past, vegans were pretty much dismissed as hippie fruitcakes. So why are so many people listening to the message now? And what does the future hold in store for plant-based ingredients? Well, the perfect person to discuss this is with us now, Paul Shapiro. He's been involved with communicating these issues for a long time, both as CEO of the Better Meat Company and as author of Clean Meat, How Growing Your Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. So, Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Steph, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Now, first of all, most important question of the entire interview, what did you have for breakfast today? And no fibbing.
I would never fib, I can assure you. So I make a smoothie every morning. However, my wife jokes with me because it's not really that smooth. It's more like a chunky. So I don't
porridge.
I don't blend it. I don't turn the blender up high enough to make it into a smoothie. I kind of like it more chunky. So it's a mixture of greens, fruit, seeds, nuts, some plant-based milk, and I mean, it's kind of stereotypical, actually, for basically what you're talking about the perception of what people eat plant-based eat. But I actually love having like a fruit and green smoothie in the morning. So
it's a great start and good for the stool, as we say. Now, we've talked a lot on this podcast over the past 18 months about things like the pandemic and its influence on the plant-based explosion. But let's go back to before that, to 2018, which was the year your book came out and the year that your company launched. So obviously a big coming together. So how clever were you? Did you anticipate the take-up of veganism would be so powerful and so quick? You know, did you see it coming? Were you in advance or were you part of that tsunami of change?
I would certainly not say that I was clever. What I would say, though, is that I have for decades, as you pointed out, been calling for a move to eating fewer animals and more plants. The planet's just not getting any bigger. Humanity's footprint on the planet is getting a lot bigger, but the planet isn't getting any bigger. And one of the principal ways that we leave that footprint is through our food print. Really in the amount of meat that we eat, because it just takes a lot of land, a lot of water, a lot of greenhouse gas emissions and more to produce all of these animals who we then end up slaughtering. The problem is, though, that unfortunately, even knowing all these facts, and you correctly point out, Steph, that people are aware of this, it's mainstream thinking, but even knowing all these facts about how bad raising all these animals for food is for climate and for public health and for animal welfare, meat consumption still continues to rise. It's still going up. Mm. And so, yes, plant-based foods are exploding, but so is meat at the same time. And so the reason I wrote the book Clean Meat is because it's basically chronicling an industry that is trying to mimic the meat experience that people have today, but in a far less harmful way. So it's kind of stuff like, you know, if you think about it, you walk into a room and you hit a light switch on the wall, like what you want is the experience of an illuminated room, right? You want light in the room. You're not so much thinking about whether it's renewable energy or whether it's fossil fuels that is producing that light. You just want light. Well, similarly, I think a lot of people just want meat. They don't really think about the fact that animals were raised and slaughtered. And if they did think about it, they probably would prefer that animals not be slaughtered. So the question that animates me is, in the same way that we want the same conveniences that fossil fuels provide us, but with renewable energy instead, what can we do to provide the same meat experience, but without having to raise animals? Mm-hmm. And there's lots of ways to do that. There's lots of ways. You can grow animal cell culture. You can turn plants into meat. You can make microbial fermentation type meats. Lots of things that you can do. But that's why I wrote the book, Clean Meat, to explore that new burgeoning field of actually creating the meat experience for people without the need to raise and slaughter animals to get it.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because when people start arguing about meat eating or not meat eating, they kind of say, well, if you're going to eat something that tastes like meat, then why not just eat meat? And what's the point? It's like, you've completely, what? Are you just riding roughshod over the sensible arguments here? And I think a lot of people really do put them, you know, throw everything in the way of it. But the big question is,
Why now? So I think there's a message that somehow has come through about veganism and about plant-based, which has worked over the last, I would say, over the last 5 to 7 years, really, when it hadn't worked for 100 years beforehand. And what's interesting is not just that it's worked for this particular concept, but, you know, how can we tap into this coming together of ideas that creates an energy that makes change? If we could do that with nutrition itself and solve things like the UK and the US's obesity problems, is there something that we can learn? What, again, back to this point of the communication, what was it that suddenly made the change? And can we bottle that?
Well, I hope it can be bottled, but I think you're right, Steph. I think there has been a shift. And part of that, I think, has been this, you know, in the past, plant-based eating or veganism, it was oftentimes associated with like an all or nothing, maybe even puritanical approach. And that has changed with the rise of things like Meatless Monday, or like what cookbook author Mark Bittman does, where he talks about being vegan before 6 p.m. and then after 6 p.m. he eats whatever he wants. I was actually talking with a person just the other day who told me that she does plant-based Monday through Friday, then on the weekends she does whatever she wants. And I think the embrace of this type of a lifestyle as something that is not all or nothing, but is something that everybody can be a part of, no matter where on the spectrum you are, has helped to lead to a mainstreaming of this. And that, yeah, you might still want to eat meat, but you're also maybe the type of person who enjoys eating a plant-based burger every once in a while. And I think that's what's helping drive this. And so if you look at data on who is buying all of this plant-based meat, nearly none of it is coming from vegans and vegetarians. It's mostly coming from meat consumers who want to be eating healthier and they want meat. And, you know, to go back to your earlier joke about why would people who don't want to eat meat eat things that taste like meat? Well, it's like saying, you know, like, you know, if you imagine if somebody had told like Elon Musk, like, hey, you know, why would somebody who wants to drive a gas powered car, why would they ever want, if they don't want gas, then why do they want this electric car? It's like, well, you know, I can't tell you how many times people, Steph, say to me like, oh, I could totally be vegetarian, but, you know, I could never give up X, right? I could never give up burgers or whatever. It's like, well, here's your chance. Here's a burger. This tastes just like a burger. This is your chance right now. I wish that more people would be happy to eat things like bean and rice burritos and lentil soup and hummus. Those plant-based foods are awesome. I wish more people would eat them, but we got to play the cards as they're dealt. And there really does seem to be a meat tooth that humans seem to have. I mean, you know,
a meat tooth. Yeah. Beautiful, you see. You've got it all going on.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, you know, it's like every culture that starts escaping poverty and they start getting more affluent, whether in China or India, et cetera, the first thing they do is they start eating more meat. You know, the richer nations eat the most meat, the poorer nations eat the least meat, because it's very resource intensive to produce meat. Well, you know, there's a reason why people start eating meat once they start getting more money. And so far, it does appear that pretty much people eat about as much meat as they can get their hands on, for the most part. Yeah. There are a few exceptions, and meat consumption does tend to decline during periods of economic recession. But, you know, look, we got to play the cards as they're dealt. And meat demand is helping to drive climate change, deforestation, wildlife extinction, pandemic amplification, and more. And like, we can't just hope that people will just do the right thing, right? Like, you've got to provide alternatives. Like, just in the same way we need wind energy, solar energy, geothermal energy, and more to combat fossil fuels, when it comes to factory farming, we need lots of alternatives to mimic that experience. And
there's not just one solution.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, now we're talking sort of about the concept a bit too much. Let's talk about the Better Meat Company. I'm interested because you're an ingredients company. You're not selling one particular, you know, patty in a wrap in a shop. You are selling the ingredients themselves. So you're a formulations company. Can you explain a little bit more about that and about what your ultimate business goal is?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if you think, Steph, right now about the way that plant-based meat is made, nearly all of it is made from one of three crops. It's made from peas, soy, or wheat, or some combination thereof. And what you'll notice about all three of those is they have one thing in common. They're all plants. And plants are very far away from animals, evolutionarily speaking. So you got to do a good amount to make a plant taste like an animal, because you've got to mill it and fractionate it and isolate it and then extrude it. There's all these things, all these processes that take place. Well, what we at the Better Meat Co. are doing is not going to the plant kingdom at all. We're going to a different kingdom altogether, which is fungi. And fungi, you know, a lot of times people, if they even think about them as something other than plants, they just think of them as kind of maybe like a lower order of plants, but they're not. They are a completely separate kingdom. And in fact, they are far more like animals than they are like plants. So fungi, just like animals, breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2. We know plants, of course, do the opposite. Plants just put themselves out in the sun and they photosynthesize, whereas fungi, just like animals, have to search out their food and digest it and eat it. So, you know, there's a reason why mushrooms have a far more meat-like texture than do plants. In fact, in Asian cuisine, mushrooms have been used for centuries as a meat replacement. The problem is mushrooms don't have much protein. They have a good texture, but they don't have much protein. And so what we at the Better Meat Co. are doing are using little microscopic fungi and subjecting them to a special kind of fermentation where we feed them potatoes. And just in the same way that a cow eats grass and converts it into a steak, our little microscopic fungi eat potatoes and they convert it into a food that looks and tastes like meat. And so there's no real processing that we have to do. Just through the magic of fermentation alone, we are capable of creating a product that straight out of the fermenter has the texture of animal meat. And unlike that cow who takes more than a year of feeding her before you slaughter her, our fermentations are complete in less than one day. So we can feed our fungi the potatoes and they convert it from a potato, which is 1% protein, within hours to a food that has the texture of meat and has 45% protein. It's almost like magic, but you know, Steph, it's not magic. It's just science. It's just fermentation. But it is a fantastic process that allows us to forgo plants, move to the fungi world to create a much better meat alternative that is a whole food, extremely minimally processed, and is really high in protein, high in iron, and high in fiber. And you know, you joked earlier about, you know, my smoothie being good for the stool. Well, I'll tell you, people need fiber. So, you know, right now it's funny, like everybody's obsessed with protein. You know, you see these like front of food packages, X grams of protein, right? But nobody who's listening to this podcast is protein deficient. Not one. And you probably have never met somebody who's protein deficient either. Yet nearly everybody, more than 9 out of 10 people in the Western world, are fiber deficient. We're not getting enough fiber. And that is a real problem because it's not just constipation. It's also colon cancer and all these other ailments that are really serious that not getting enough fiber can do. Well, where do you get fiber? You know, fiber is not in animals because animals have skeletons to hold them up. Plants don't have skeletons, and that's why they make fiber so that it holds them up. Fiber is basically the skeleton of a plant or a fungi. And we have to get more fiber. We are fiber deficient as a society, and it's leading to really bad health outcomes. And so this type of meat that we are producing at the Better Meat Co. is, yes, it's high in protein, so it's got that protein that you want, but it's got the fiber that you need. And so we provide our mycoprotein as an ingredient to food companies so they can make really great next generation alternative meats. And for meat producers who want to use fewer animals, they can blend this into their meats to make a better product as well.
And innovation is a really key part of this, isn't it? And I'm interested in where the drive for the innovation comes from. Is it companies saying to you, we want a thing, or we want this to be achieved with less processing, or is there a different version of this, or is there a lower allergenic version of this? Or is it you sitting around with your tech team saying, why don't we try and do this Wednesday? Is it you come up with the new ideas, or is it meeting a demand?
Yeah, I do think it's some of both, Steph, but the primary thing is us trying to figure out how to get the texture of meat in a very economic way so you don't have to have a multitude of processes that add cost at every single step. And so our goal is to, I mean, you know, flavor is actually surprisingly much easier to mimic than texture. Texture is really the harder thing to get. And there's a lot of effort being made to try to make plants have the texture of animal meat. And that's great. I mean, I'm rooting for them just in the same way I said earlier. You want solar, you want wind, you want geothermal, you want plant-based meat, you want fungi, you want all types of solutions. But we sat down and thought, how can we create something that's actually cost-effective so we don't have to do a lot to it and it is going to have that texture? And if you were to try our mycoprotein compared to plant-based proteins, there's no comparison. The texture is just dramatically more meat-like. And so that's really what drove us on this quest. And I'll put it this way, you know, demand is through the roof for this. You know, people, these companies want it because everybody is trying to get the next thing. you know, then, you know, if you look, like, there's a lot of companies who are making soy-based products or pea-based products or wheat-based products. But in terms of mycoprotein, there's really only been one company for decades that has been doing it, which is, of course, Corn, Q-U-O-R-N, the British behemoth in the space. And they're using one species of fungi. And I like corn products. I think that's great. But there are thousands and thousands of fungi out there to use. And so just like we make foods from lots of different plants, we can make foods from lots of different fungi. And we have a completely different species that, you know, we believe is really effective at doing what we're trying to do here. So that's what drove us. And so far, at least, the food industry has shown extremely high interest.
So you've just announced a new product, and I just wondered if you can use that as an example for explaining how it comes about. It's Riza or Riza, if you can explain a little bit more about that.
Whether you speak English or you speak Greek, you just got it right, but they're different. So it's just a Greek word for root. You know, we're using the roots of fungi, sometimes known as mycelium or mycoprotein. We call it Riza, but in short, what Riza is a whole food alternative meat that on its own has more protein than eggs, more iron than beef, more fiber than oats, more potassium than bananas. And because it is a product of microbial fermentation, it naturally contains vitamin B12, which plant foods do not. And so this is a real superfood that you can use if you're, let's say, a food company and you want to make a really awesome animal-free meat. You can use Riza to make a whole variety of these products. Right now, the plant-based meat world is pretty much all ground meat mimicry. So it's like burgers, dogs, nuggets, sticks, and so on. But with Riza, you can do all of that, but you can also make whole muscle mimicry. So you can
Are we talking ribeye steak here? Come on.
Yes. And so actually in Sacramento, California, just last month in August, was the first time an American steakhouse served an animal-free steak. So keep on, there's no animal-free steak on the market. You can't go to the supermarket and buy an animal-free steak because it's really hard to do that with plants. But with fungi, we have been able to do it. And so a steakhouse here in Sacramento called Bennett's ended up selling this mycoprotein steak that we make, and people loved it. You know, and
that's really exciting.
People lined up outside of the restaurant. The mayor came to it, and she got a steak. I mean, it really was a popular event. And so we're looking forward to bringing that steak by partnering with a food company that wants to bring that steak to their customers and making it happen, because Riza is extremely versatile. It can also be used for chicken breasts and all types of other whole muscle applications.
That's a big step change, isn't it? When you can make a steak, I think that's crossing the Rubicon. Okay, let's go back to the concept of communication. What's been the thing that's made the most difference to the boom in plant-based or fungal-based? Is it social media? What, you know, is it the different platforms? Is it the fact that things change? Is it that people are more obsessed with diets? What was the thing that changed everything?
I think people for hundreds of years have been pretty focused on diets. You know, you go back and look at these like old-timey 19th century fad diets that were out there that people were doing. So I think, you know, people have been looking for health and wellness cures for a long time. However, I think that at some point, there's such an overwhelming preponderance of evidence, and it leads to the amplification of certain things. And so there are certain like breakout books and documentaries that I think have really made a difference. So for example, the China study by T. Colin Campbell, where he looks at the patterns of traditional Chinese cuisine, which is overwhelmingly plant-based. Then also a blockbuster runaway mega bestseller called How Not to Die by Dr. Michael Greger, where he looks at what are the leading causes of death in the Western world? And then he goes chapter by chapter to describe what you can do to reduce your risk of dying from that particular disease. And, you know, time and time again, it's enjoying a whole foods plant-based diet. And so then you look at certain documentaries, whether the documentaries like The Game Changers, which talks about how many athletes are powering themselves and achieving superior athletic performance through plant-based eating. And I think the amplification of these types of books and documentaries really has made a big difference in what people are thinking about this. Even, and you correctly, I think, point out, Steph, that social media is also having a big influence. You know, there's certain kind of mega influencers on Instagram and TikTok and so on who are touting the very clear benefits of plant-based eating. Finally, I do think that climate is part of this, especially for younger people. So, you know, the United Nations reports that raising animals for food creates more greenhouse gas emissions than all of the transportation sector combined. more than all the cars, planes, trains, boats, et cetera, all combined. All that transportation causes less greenhouse gas emissions than raising animals for food. And, you know, people who are in their teens or 20s right now, and they're looking at another, hopefully 75 or 80 years of life for themselves, and they're realizing, like, you know, right now, the horrors that are happening, from wildfires to droughts to floods and so on, like, this is the best it's going to be. Like, it's only going to get worse. The climate issue is only going to get worse. And so it's hard to, you know, look and say, like, oh, you know, these big energy companies need to change. It's a lot easier to look at ourselves and say, what can I do to actually make a difference? Like, it may cost me a lot of money to, let's say, buy solar panels and put them on my roof if I even own a house. But anybody can eat less meat. And it's actually, you know, an effective thing if enough people do it to start making a difference in the climate problem.
And what was your personal journey in this? What was the inspiration for you to make a change?
You know, it started stuff for me as just a love for animals, honestly. I went plant-based in 1993, so it's been about 28 years for me. And I learned what happened to animals in slaughterhouses and in factory farms, and it just was something I didn't want to be a part of. I really couldn't stand the thought of this violence being inflicted on animals. And so that was sufficient for me. But then I learned about all the health benefits after that. And so I didn't, you know, as a teenager, I didn't really know much about anything. Actually, I didn't know much about anything, but I knew I didn't want to hurt animals. And then when I went plant-based, I actually started feeling much better. I was like an unintended side effect of doing this. And I remember at that time, do you remember Carl Lewis? He was a sprinter and Olympian.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah, he was like the Usain Bolt back then in the 90s. You know, he's like the number one Olympian in the world. This dude was incredible. And I worshiped this guy, like a poster of him on my room wall and all that. And I was reading an interview with him. It's like my idol. And he talked about, this is back in like the early 90s, and he talked about how his best performances in the Olympics were when he was vegan. And I was like, it blew me away, you know, because
that is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, because I, you know, here I was, I thought, well, this is kind of like a good thing to do, but I didn't realize that it could actually fuel athletic performance and make me, you know, make me fitter. And that really transformed things for me. And I started running track because of that. And I mean, I just became just a different person, honestly. So that's what got me into it. And I have, you know, it may seem unlikely, but I have also been really concerned about pandemics for a long time. In fact, in my book, Clean Meat, that came out, as you pointed out, in 2018, I have a whole section on pandemics in there and how raising animals for food is a real cause of concern. In fact, even more interestingly than my own predictions about it is that just recently, the United Nations put out a report. It's called Preventing the Next Pandemic. And they list what are the most likely causes of the next pandemic. Number one on the UN's list is increasing demand for animal protein. Number two is intensification of agriculture, meaning confining animals in more tighter and tighter spaces so that they can amplify viruses. And number three is the bushmeat trade, meaning slaughtering wildlife for meat. So on the UN's list of the most likely causes of the next pandemic, numbers one, two, and three all relate to humanity's desire to eat meat. Like, this is at the root of so many problems that we are facing right now. And just like fossil fuels, we seem to be having a hard time weaning ourselves off of our meat addiction. But fortunately, there are lots of companies. Mine, the Better Meat Co., is only one of them. But there are many companies that are putting oars in the water to try to create a clean protein space that will make humanity less reliant on the exploitation of animals and more reliant on things like plants and fungi.
And earlier on, you were mentioning flexitarianism, that you know, lots of people who are fueling the boom in plant-based food weren't, you know, they're not going to be vegans. They're just making a little bit of a change. Do you think that's part of the key to these changes? You know, it's not about guilt tripping people anymore. It's not about you know, just little bits of meat and using meat as a condiment. It's allowing people something that acknowledges that you love food. It's not saying meat bad, plant good or fungi good. It's saying how about a little bit of a change? And doing, it's actually that the argument is given with grace rather than with an absolutist, you're either with us or you're against us. And maybe that there's a little bit of kindness to that, which helps people change. Then they try out some, you know, some plant-based meat and they go, oh, hang on. Okay, all of my thoughts about this to begin with need to be changed. Is it that, you know, is the carrot approach better than the stick approach?
It's literally a carrot approach, actually, in this case. People are eating those carrots. But first of all, you know, Steph, I think you've correctly diagnosed the issue. It reminds me of the old joke, what will you never find in a vegan bookstore? A humor section. And, you know, like, yeah, there's like some truth in the jest, right? I mean, there's been a reputational problem. And, you know, look, you know, I am one of these people who I wish more people were interested in becoming vegetarian or vegan. I think that would be fantastic. At the same time, that's like also saying I wish that, you know, we wouldn't be using fossil fuels. But considering that we are, I really hope that we have fuel efficiency standards that improve the fuel efficiency of cars so that we can use fewer fossil fuels. Mm. I really hope that people will, you know, use less air conditioning, just as an example. And we have to look at this in the same way. It's not all or nothing. In fact, you know, interestingly, I was giving a talk and a woman in the audience raised her hand and she said, you know, I could totally be a vegetarian, but I just can't say no to my grandmother's Thanksgiving turkey. And I said, then eat the turkey. You know, if you want to be a vegetarian 364 days a year and you eat your grandmother's turkey one day a year, you know, there's no police that's going to come and arrest you, right? I mean, you know, look, this isn't all or nothing. Like the goal is to continually strive for improvement. And that's not just on these issues, on everything in our lives. And so I agree with you, Steph. I really think that we have to be pragmatic. And, you know, it's nice to get up on a high horse and to make proclamations about what's right and wrong and black and white. But what actually seems to work is what you're talking about, which is, you know, having an outstretched hand rather than a fist.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot that the other arguments can learn from this approach. I mean, for me, we've been banging on about nutrition in the UK for dozens of years, and we've not made a serious change. And I think that's mainly because we say one food is good and one food is bad. And it's not done, again, it's not done with grace. It's not done with the understanding that people love chips. They love a burger. This is bad food. And this is taught in schools. And that once you change it, okay, the veganism argument has come at a moment in time when lots of different things have conspired to help change, i.e. the climate change argument coming to the fore as well. But I think also that it's the nature of trying to convince people. And I think there's a lot we can learn from this in trying to get people to eat differently. Okay, last couple of questions then, really. What excites you most about the alternative protein market at the moment? Obviously, you're coming up with new products, but what else? Is there an energy there that is unprecedented? Are there people there that are wanting a change? What's the big drive for you that makes you excited about the world?
What I'm particularly excited about is so many things, Steph, but I'll tell you what I'm really excited about is that in this space, the alternative protein space, you have this influx of entrepreneurs and investors who are completely motivated to try to save the world, basically. You know, this isn't, you know, I hope that people do make money from this. You know, you want saving the world to be profitable, right? It's been profitable to destroy the world for a long time. So we got to make it profitable to actually do good. That's great. But so many of the people in this space, I've known them, many of them, for years or decades, and that's not their primary motivation. Their primary motivation is to try to solve this problem, to save humanity from itself, to reduce humanity's footprint on the planet, to reforest our Earth. And that is, in my view, one of the most exciting things, because you have this group of folks who oftentimes really don't view each other as competitors, but view each other as collaborators, and everybody is on the same boat with oars in the water trying to row in the same direction. So, you know, that's not 100% of the time, but I really think there is a collaborative approach to this industry, and we are in a bit of a golden era for alternative proteins right now, where you're seeing the birth of a new industry. It's kind of like if you were looking at the birth of solar panels, 20 years ago or so, you're looking at the birth of this new industry here, where we can divorce meat production from livestock rearing and create really interesting and cool novel culinary experiences that people haven't had before, by creating this new type of meat industry.
And has that been fueled by a sort of a new approach to ethical investment, not just in crowdfunding, but in investors looking for something that to fit in their portfolio, to either for themselves or for their shareholders or for their, you know, private equity individuals who want to also sort of see a little bit of good alongside their, you know, Anglo-American tobacco investments?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Beyond Meat IPO, which was the most successful IPO of the last 20 years, raised a lot of eyebrows, and it attracted a lot of interest in the space from the investor class. But if you look, for example, just in Britain, I can think of two billionaires off the top of my head, Jeremy Collar and Jim Mellon, who are, you know, both making it their mission in life to move financial markets to a place where we can divest from animal agriculture. You know, what they're trying to do, I don't mean literally divest the money. I mean, where they are investing in companies that have the potential to render the raising of animals obsolete. You know, Steph, if you think about, like, for example, the whale industry, you know, we used to 150 years ago light all of our homes with whale oil. Mm. People were slaughtering whales left and right. There were concerns about the sustainability and the extinction of whales actually back then. But what ended up saving whales was not humane sentiment. It was the invention of kerosene, which rendered that whaling obsolete. Yeah. Because it had a much cleaner and more efficient way to light our homes. And that's what we're trying to do here as well. If people are not going to stop tormenting and slaughtering animals because it's bad for those animals, we can create technologies that render that exploitation obsolete. And many of the smart investors are putting their money there because they see the creation of more efficient innovations to producing high protein foods are really going to do that. And so I'm excited to see people like Jim Mellon and Jeremy Collar and other people of great financial means putting their money where their mouth is, because their mouths are plant-based. And so now they got to get some money out there to help do for chickens and turkeys and pigs what kerosene did for whales. Yeah.
Okay, last question then. Looking at the future of plant-based food, what's the one thing, the one twist that you think, you know, that I think, as you say, it's not necessarily the most obvious thing that makes the biggest change. What has surprised you most in the last 3 or 4 years in terms of a new way of looking at solving these problems?
The biggest surprise for me, which is a very pleasant surprise, is the explosion of plant-based meat onto fast food menus. You know, yeah. This was the type of thing where it's like you had to go to natural food co-ops, mm-hmm, for a long time to get anything like this. Now, you know, you're going to Burger King and Carl's Jr. and other fast food chains, and you can get plant-based meat. That has been completely shocking to me. And, you know, I would say I have eaten more fast food in the last 3 years than in the last 30 years prior to that because of this. I mean, it has been a truly welcome experience. And, you know, it's not to say that fast food is health food. I would never say that. But it is to say that a lot of people get fast food. And you want to make sure these options are available for people so that somebody going into Burger King and they're looking for a Whopper, that they can get the Impossible Whopper, as an example. And it, you know, it's not as good as, let's say, a kale salad for you, but it is better than a Whopper for you. And it's certainly better than a Whopper for the planet and for animals.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think you're right. It's again, step change. Suddenly everything changed when we saw it on the menus like that. Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking to us. Absolutely inspiring story.
It's great to talk with you, Steph. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from food security to the plant-based revolution. Recent highlights include editions on food health claims and the potential of insect protein. Follow us to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.